Babjus Day to another installment of Disney Dissected, a podcast offering critical literary analysis of the Disney animated classics canon. I'm Andrew Isla.
And I am JoJo Seams. And today we are going to be visiting 1951's Alice in Wonderland, the all-cartoon musical wonder film.
All-cartoon musical wonder film.
As it was originally advertised.
All the posters in 1951 said, "All cartoon musical wonder film," which is one of the best taglines I've ever seen.
Absolutely. And was it all that? Was it an all cartoon musical wonder film?
Shall we go ask Alice?
Oh. We'll also be asking Tracy Mock, who is our guest this week.
For today's discussion of Alice in Wonderland is writer, comedian, artist Tracy Mock. How are you doing today, Tracy?
Hello, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Glad to have you. We're all set here. Rewatched the movie, reread both of the books that this was based on in preparation, so.
Which does not take very long to do.
It took about 2 hours to read both of them.
Yeah, I had forgotten how little there is in these books. You know, obviously everyone knows there's not much of a story to Alice in Wonderland. That's why it's so, like, hard to adapt. But it wasn't until I sat down to reread them in preparation for this, which was the first time I'd read them in at least a decade, that I was like, man, they're over in a snap. I mean, they are children's books after all. But yeah, they go by really fast.
Yeah. Tracy, have you read the books recently or at all?
I have, not recently though. I do have the, like, enormous annotated book of the Alice stories. I'd like to go back and pour over that again, but I have read them, and the story of Alice has always interested me in its various forms over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a pretty wide-ranging universal kind of appeal to it, doesn't it? I think it's one of the most iconic and lasting pieces of, you know, not just children's literature, but fantasy literature in general.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's probably why you see it in various forms or adaptations or homages in just about everything that exists.
Absolutely. I think this is probably one of the most adapted stories.
Definitely.
Since it was first published in 1865. And it's interesting because it doesn't really lend itself to adaptation very easily. I think people think that it will because it's very, you know, it's got all these striking visuals and everything, but
yeah, there's certainly many set iconic moments and images, and that seems to be what everyone wants to tap into whenever they try to do something Alice related or even just tangentially, but, you know, just the stuff between the looking glass or just various Wonderland themed images, and it's very all over the place.
Yeah, but with such strong iconography.
Yeah, I think the reason that so many film adaptations don't work is because, you know, like we said, the appeal is all kind of in the images, but it's also in the prose. Like, you know, there's obviously not really a story, but what really, like, grabs you and what really makes the story, you know, so iconic is, like, the way Lewis Carroll puts words together in describing what's happening. And of course, you get none of that on screen. And I'm always surprised that, like, there's so little, there are so few adaptations of this story that have, like, a narrator. Because I would think that would be my first thing if I was going to, like, write an Alice in Wonderland script. It was like, well, we need a narrator to say Lewis Carroll's words.
Right. Yeah. And I think it does get either too, I don't know, simplified or normalized by, like, literally, here's a bunch of weirdos, but mostly it's sort of just, you're just being put in a world where there's frustrating weirdos and you don't get to have the fun of just how it's being told, and more just in that, you know, well, this is the stuff that happens.
Yeah, like, the, you know, the whole point of it is to be as nonsense and, you know, random, really, as possible. And so many filmmakers or people adapting it into different media try to either string it together into some kind of plot where all the characters have, like, motivations that interweave with each other, or they try to give it some kind of theme where it's, like, a rumination on the meaning of nonsense. And it's like, none of that really works and kind of just ends up destroying the whole thing. So, yeah, there have been lots and lots of versions of the story, but the one we are specifically talking about today is the Walt Disney Studio animated version from 1951. So let's take a look at the year 1951 and see what was going on in the world at the time.
All right, 1951. The 22nd Amendment was passed in that year, limiting the United States president to only 2 terms of office. The 17-point agreement for the peaceful liberation of Tibet was signed, which has the People's Republic of China formally taking control of Tibet. China is also heavily involved in the Korean War on one side, and the United States is also involved with the other, Korea, during that conflict. The big movies of that year were A Streetcar Named Desire, An American in Paris, The African Queen, and Scrooge, or as it was released in the United States, A Christmas Carol. That's the one starring Alastair Sim, which is my second favorite film adaptation of that story.
After
The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Obviously.
Obviously. Dennis the Menace made his debut in newspaper comics. The Catcher in the Rye was published this year. The big musical stars were Perry Como, Mario Lanza, Nat King Cole, Rosemary Clooney, Tony Bennett, and Johnny Ray. Dragnet and I Love Lucy first debuted on TV, and the first color television broadcasts were made in that year, though of course that would not become popular until after. McCarthyism is in full swing at this time in American life and politics. There was so much distrust of communism, people looking around, trying to get a sense of normalcy in this scary new world. Even though we had just come out of World War II victorious, there was a great fear at this time that that peace would not last. And so it's interesting in that context that of this, it's interesting in that context of trying to find normalism, that here we have a film adaptation of one of the most abnormal stories ever written.
Yeah, Disney doing Alice in Wonderland is kind of a weird paradox in that obviously any version of Alice in Wonderland is going to be weird if it lives up to the book at all. But also it's like, you know, it was such a safe bet just as a property for Disney, because it was something that had really been on Walt Disney's mind for decades at that point. His first big successful project back in the 20s was a series of silent live-action animated combination shorts called the Alice Comedies, where a live-action little girl would go into a cartoon wonderland and run around and have adventures. And those are really cute. There's a couple of them that we've seen. They're on the Alice in Wonderland Blu-ray. They have one on there that's kind of gives you a taste of it.
They're pretty fun. We'll try to put one in the show notes.
Yeah, they made 50 of them, which seems crazy. In like 2 or 3 years. very, you know, very early rudimentary animation. You know, it's kind of amazing again to look at those and know that they're only like 15 years before work started on Snow White, because it just seems like an entirely different medium by that point. And then, of course, as Walt got into the 30s and founded the studio and started looking at doing feature-length stuff, Alice in Wonderland was on kind of their short list of the studio of properties they wanted to work on. Part of what held them off for a while was that there were other, you know, silent films and live action versions happening in the 20s and 30s that kind of put them off the idea of jumping in with it because everyone else was doing it.
Right. There had been at least three different silent film versions and maybe as many as a dozen live action, either short subjects or full-length features that had already existed by 1951 of Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, so they're kind of working on the story as, you know, on the back burner as they're doing those, you know, first bunch of Golden Age animated movies throughout Snow White and Pinocchio and Fantasia and Dumbo. They've kind of got some story people working on it throughout that whole time, trying to figure out how to bring the book into an animated movie. There are a bunch of story sketches from the late 30s that are the look of them are very much like Tenniel's illustrations from the book, which they had actually purchased the rights to because they weren't yet in the public domain in the 30s, and those kind of got abandoned because it's too grotesque a style for animation at the time. That Disney had this kind of house style that we're developing, and it was just too far out there to do these kind of weird proportions, semi-realistic characters that were like the original illustrations. And then World War II happened, and you know, they got into that era where they were doing package films to save money, and everything kind of again got put on the back burner because of the war. And coming out of the war, when they could finally afford to do feature-length films again, you know, their first foray back was Cinderella, which was kind of a safe bet because it was a big princess movie in the style of Snow White. And Alice in Wonderland came right behind it, kind of in tandem production-wise. And, you know, I think at the time they kind of figured, well, what's everybody crying out for us to do that, you know, we'll definitely sell tickets just right out the gate. And so many people had been, like, writing to the Disney studio asking when they were going to do Alice in Wonderland, so they finally came back to it.
Yeah, it seems almost like Alice in Wonderland was a product of a feeling of obligation on Walt's part more than passion necessarily. Obviously a great fondness for the book, but you know, I almost have the feeling that he chose it as a property, like you just said, because it would be a safer commercial bet because it's such a well-beloved and popular, universally known book, but also out of a sense of obligation that, hey, the great cartoon studio has to do this. Great children's book.
That's interesting that you say it comes right after Cinderella. I didn't realize that because it stylistically it feels like a bit of a leap for just being, you know, probably just like a few months in between.
Yeah, they came out a year apart. I guess I don't know what month they came out, but Cinderella was 50 and Alice in Wonderland was 51, so they would have been in production, you know, overlapping certainly.
Yeah.
I know Alice in Wonderland came out in July of that year.
And what really, I think the key to both of those movies that really got the ball rolling was that Mary Blair came on board at the studio as a designer, because those two movies are both very Mary Blair, but especially Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, she was a great concept artist who worked in a modernist style very, very early on. And I think is one of the great masters of modernist illustration. She was a concept artist, and I think she really became the forefront of what this movie was going to be. Originally, they were going to work in a style that hewed closer to John Tenniel's illustrations from the book. They're some of the most famous book illustrations ever made in the unmistakable Tenniel style of black and white, lots of cross-hatching. He was one of the great political cartoonists working in the day. And a lot of people have actually looked at his illustrations trying to see if there's a little bit of caricature of well-known figures showing up in the Alice in Wonderland illustrations, you know, looking for meaning in the nonsense, as people love to do with this book. They were originally going to hew closer to his style, but like you said, Andrew, they thought it would be kind of grotesque.
Yeah, if you look at some of those story sketches from those like 30s attempts, they're really disturbing.
Yeah, a lot of them are downright scary. Because
it's like
honestly.
The style of the Tenniel illustrations, but rendered more realistically. It's kind of like Uncanny Valley thing going on a little bit.
There's sort of like a body horror thing happening with some of the proportions. And frankly, you know, those Cheshire Cat drawings just scare the heck out of me.
Yeah.
Both in the book and in the concept art they were developing early on. Like, really, really, really scary. Very toothy. Sharp, pointy teeth and big, horrible, staring eyes at you. Very scary stuff.
So, yeah, Mary Blair comes to the studio in the late 40s. One of the first, definitely an early example of a woman getting a job other than ink and paint in animation.
Yeah, even that was unusual at the time.
Yeah, that, you know, a woman was making creative decisions, which had not really been allowed in animation up to that point for some ridiculous, well, I guess we know the ridiculous reason, it's the patriarchy, but...
The patriarchy. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of faith in, the ideas that women would have going forward, though I personally entertain the notion that there was something of a fear among the male creative professionals that they might get upstaged a little bit if they started hiring some women, and that just would not do to their fragile male egos.
Yeah. Animation was definitely a boys' club in the early days. Not just at Disney, but, you know, everyone who was doing animation.
This is my personal theory. Just fear of great lady cartoonists being great.
I'll subscribe to that theory.
Yeah.
And she came on during, I think, the first time she does work for the studio is Saludos Amigos and the Three Caballeros. There's some sequences in those that are really highly influenced by her. I know she went on that big, you know, trip to Mexico with the staff to gain inspiration and stuff for those. But, of course, those being little package movies that are kind of propaganda first and foremost, or if not propaganda, they're at least kind of... They have a political agenda, those movies do, of just in their existing, which is kind of an interesting story we'll get to when we do those.
Right.
Once they get back into making features after the war, of course, is her first chance to really show off in, you know, setting the tone for a big project. And there's definitely a lot of it in Cinderella in certain sequences, like I think, you know, kind of the landscapes of the kingdom, like going to the ball. I know there's a lot of concept art of hers that just kind of went directly into that.
Right. The two things she was great at were composition and color. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of her compositions showing up in Cinderella in some of the final work. You see some of her compositions and again her use of color in Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Alice in Wonderland is the one where, you know, you look at it and wow, this is full on Mary Blair, because it's not only her compositions that are getting used, her interesting use of shape, you know, very modernist kind of use of perspectives where the landscapes would be kind of flattened out, not a whole lot of rendering to give you a sense of depth, but instead just using layers of flat color to build up a world. And the soft shapes that are not quite geometric, not quite organic, but sort of rounded off geometry in her shapes, kind of taking interesting twists and turns here and there. And the other big thing that was emblematic of her style was very bold use of strongly saturated color. And all of those things are full display in the entire look of Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, basically, the single most Mary Blair-y thing in all of Disney is It's a Small World. Like, if you want, if you're not sure who Mary Blair is, like, she's It's a Small World. That whole aesthetic is kind of her deal. And I think that's kind of the key that finally got the ball rolling for Walt on seeing how to do Alice in Wonderland, because they're kind of natural, or they're kind of, you know, lush storybook painting of the Golden Age wasn't right for it, and trying to work off the Tenniel illustrations wasn't right for it, but Mary
it was
Blair,
prohibitively expensive, if nothing expensive. Else. Imagine trying to do an animated feature in cross-hatching. Oh, my goodness.
Also think of how terrifying the theme park ride would have ended up looking.
Oh, God.
Oh, my goodness.
But in Mary Blair, then, you know, finally they had somebody who could give it this sort of whimsical and, you know, simple but beautiful and elegant and very designy kind of look, which is a really good fit for the characters.
Yeah, and it is an absolutely gorgeously designed movie.
Yeah, and I did not truly appreciate the color palette of this movie until we watched it on Blu-ray. When you see it in HD, like, the colors, man, the colors of this movie are something else. It's the department where I think this movie stands out most from every other Disney movie, is it's got a color palette all its own.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
It's so unusual. The neutral of this movie is black. You know, not like you usually see where, you know, your neutral is gray or brown, maybe an off-white. No, it is solid jet black as the neutral all the way through this film, which is so bold and crazy and unusual, and I love it.
Yeah. All the environments kind of just fade off into black on the peripheral of the screen.
Yeah.
And there's no, like, natural lighting sources. Everything is kind of just glowing as if it's, like, under a black light almost.
Yeah.
And it really makes the whole movie feel like one of the Disneyland dark rides.
Oh, definitely.
I think that's maybe the reason, you know, Alice in Wonderland is always pointed at as, like, their most popular of that kind of attraction at Disneyland, where you just kind of ride through the story with all the lit up figures in the dark. And I think it's because the movie already looks exactly like that. You're kind of careening through a dark room where lots of weird characters are lit up under black light. That's just the look of the movie already.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and it even gives you that moment in the movie where every character and object fades away into complete blackness until it's just left with Alice in the middle with just a little bit of light surrounding her. And it's an unusual image to be left with in a film like that.
Yeah, at the end of the Tulji Wood sequence where she's just left off in a field of black with a kind of spotlight over her because all the lights have faded away during her sad song.
So they've got kind of the visual going now when they decide to move ahead with it. There are a lot of different recorded attempts. You know, they saved everything at the Disney studio. All of their drafts and story sequences and story meetings are recorded, and there's probably more, like, just stuff in their vaults for this movie than anything else. If you ever read, like, a Disney behind the scenes book, or you watch the, you know, DVD bonus features or whatever, like, there's just so much Alice in Wonderland material because they tried so many different things.
Right. It makes sense. I mean, at the very beginning of this, we alluded to how difficult this is to adapt, and it's difficult to adapt. So they had to try so many different things to try to make a movie out of something that's just a series of strange episodes that bleed one into the other without really much of a progression of any kind. Yeah. The book comes to a climax at the trial for the Knave of Hearts. But before that, there really isn't any, you know, rising tension or inciting incidents or anything. Or that
characters that appear more than once.
Characters that appear more than once. No, there isn't anything that is a real structure for a story. They really struggled to find one.
Yeah, I think they knew right off the bat, as soon as they started looking at it, that they were going to have to try some unusual things to nail the story down. They reached kind of outside their story room, you know, much farther than they had before. Aldous Huxley sat in on some story meetings. Walt got the author of Brave New World to come in and, like, I don't know what he was going for there, but I guess Huxley came in for, like, a couple weeks worth of story meetings and
then he just kind of disappeared.
Didn't say much and then left. Which is a weird, weird story.
That's so weird.
And there's lots of records of, like, you know, they tried, you know, for a while they thought they were going to do a live-action animation combination, where it was going to be like a live-action little girl in an animated Wonderland, or that there would be bookended live-action sequence, or they tried different concepts, like the whole thing was like Lewis Carroll was, you know,
like him telling the story.
There was lots of stuff, and you know, different ways of kind of tying things together, like making up relationships between characters. I think they tried like throwing in a love story angle a couple different times. Like they thought the Knave of Hearts could be a love interest for Alice at one point,
which is
makes no sense,
ludicrous. But weird. they were trying anything to see what would stick, I guess.
And the interesting thing is, I think you know what they ended up going with sticks a lot closer to the book than any of the stuff that they tried before that. Like they kept trying to get further and further away from the book and trying to turn it into a movie, and finally they just kind of snapped back to the way the book works.
For the most part, yeah.
Stuff's kind of out of order, and they throw in stuff from the second book, which wasn't initially their plan either. They kind of threw that in halfway through production.
Right. Adding a few elements from the sequel book and deleting some sequences from the original one, mostly for pacing reasons.
Yeah. But the individual scenes that are in the movie are, you know, pretty faithful to the scenes they're based on in the book. Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised watching it again how, you know, having just read the book the same day, I read the book and then I watched the movie the same day, and I was really surprised, like, how many little lines of dialogue and you know, the way the stories play out, it's pretty much right off the page.
Yeah, it's interesting because I read this movie was criticized very heavily at the time by people who felt that it strayed too far away from the book, and they were accused of Americanizing this great work of English literature. But like I said, we just rewatched it and reread the book, and like, oh yeah, no, most of the dialogue is kind of line for line, and there's certainly an attempt to keep the spirit of the book in every moment, even when they felt they had to make some changes.
I'm surprised that the accusation was that they were Americanizing it, because I can hardly point out any moment in it where I would feel like that's being done with it. I don't know. I don't want to use the phrase excessively British, but
no, like, yeah, there's some changes made, but none of them make it more American. They make it more like a movie than a book.
Right.
Which I guess in certain ways could be seen as Americanization, but they don't shy away from it being British at all, you know?
Right. There's a little bit less poking fun at the aristocracy in that they removed the character of the Duchess and the Knave of Hearts. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. They certainly did that just for pacing reasons and to try to keep a little more focus at the big climax on Alice rather than a different character.
And because there's no way that the Duchess scene would have not been disturbing.
Oh my gosh, that would have been the worst. That would have been the worst.
Where the Duchess is screaming at and beating a baby, and Alice saves it and it turns into a pig and runs off.
Yeah, I'm pretty glad we don't have, you know, a musical number about child abuse. In the book, the song, you know, "Speak roughly to your little boy and beat him when he sneezes," is there as one of the many examples of doing a parody of an already existing poem or song, which is, you know, originally "speak gently to your little boy," and, you know, it goes on because so much of the book is just to satirize pre-existing children's literature and poetry, which was really moralistic and didactic. You know, it was the Victorian age, so it was all about good behavior and being proper and decorous in all things, and very much the book exists to just make fun of all of that and intentionally has no moral, and Alice is kind of a brat and she doesn't learn anything, and authority figures are laughed at. You know, the Duchess is an example of a bad parent, and the King and Queen of Hearts are bad rulers, and everybody keeps trying to make her recite lessons, and it's a parody of academia and teachers and any kind of dogma. So it fits in that and makes sense in that sense in the context of the book. But I'm still very glad that we don't, since that gets kind of lost a little bit in the movie, the satirical element is less strong in the film. So I'm very glad we don't have to see the Duchess abusing her baby.
Yes, I don't remember what I know I saw another live action version of this as a child, and that was always the most disturbing scene in it, was with the baby. And I couldn't tell you which adaptation that is, but I think it was in black and white.
Okay, that could be any of a number of different versions. There have been so many versions of this, but
And I'm sorry, I wish I could. It honestly, that scene only just rushed into my head when you're describing it, and I was like, oh my god, that's right, that really disturbing moment with the baby turning into a pig, and we had that on VHS, and it was very upsetting.
Are we bringing up repressed memories here?
Yes. Oh, this is awful. I haven't thought of that in 25 years.
I remember what I was gonna say earlier, and it's still relevant to the conversation.
Okay.
This whole thing of, you know, feeling pressure to fans of the book or to literary purists, I think was kind of a new thing for the Disney studio at the time, because all of their other big movies up to this point had been based on fairy tales where the details are all vague and it's all just kind of childhood stories.
Right, or there would be many different versions of the same story, who's to say which one is correct?
You know, Pinocchio was based on a children's book, but not a very well-known one. You know, it was pretty much only famous in Italy.
Yeah, it was pretty obscure outside of Italy at that point, I think.
So it wasn't like there was this legion of people who, you know, were attached to it. Bambi was based on a book, but again, not a very famous one. You know, it was a interesting non-anthropomorphized animal story.
It was sort of like a describing the natural world in prose terms, yeah, but they weren't characters.
There weren't Bambi purists.
No.
This is the first time, really, that they were like basing a film on a very specific, very well-known and much beloved book.
Right, and there are a novel. A novel by an author where there is one version.
Yeah, there's one definitive original version, and they have to adapt that. So that was kind of a new challenge for them that I'm not sure they were expecting going in, with all the kind of different attempts that they had to make to get to what they ended up with.
Right.
Well, it's nice to know that people were still complaining about that sort of thing before the internet.
Yeah, there were Lewis Carroll fanboys.
I always thought it was interesting that as far as some of the bits of poetry that kind of get left out in the more, I guess, I don't know, if you would call it more like a literal tale of having her take an adventure. But they work in some of it as just the sort of sing-songy ramblings of the Cheshire Cat.
Oh, yeah, the Jabberwocky.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jabberwocky is maybe the most famous of the many poems from the book.
Yeah, it's the thing that people know kind of apart from the rest of the story, that, like, Jabberwocky is just a poem that you kind of see recited and put on merchandise and stuff.
Right. One of the many things they were considering was actually having the Jabberwock appear in the Tolgi Wood, and it was going to be this initially very threatening creature that was then revealed to be super non-threatening. It was going to be like a silly dragon thing, or maybe a bunch of people in a costume who would all all run away.
And they had a jazz song for it.
Yeah, which would be not really fit with the rest of the movie. It's not a jazzy film.
No, I like that song though. The demo is really good. I think it could have been a great song if they'd used it for something. They wrote between those attempts in the mid-30s up through the final version, 1951, there were over 40 songs written and discarded for a potential Alice in Wonderland film at the studio.
And even as it ends up, there's like 14 different ones. It just kind of flows from song to song for the most part, almost nonstop.
This movie is wall-to-wall music in a way that not many of the other Disney movies are.
I think it it had to be that way to just have some sense of bridging one scene to another and having you accept all the weirdness that you're seeing. Somehow adding music normalizes things a little bit.
Because the songs are all kind of in a general, you know, the same neighborhood of style.
Yeah.
So it really does, it is the only thing bridging one sequence to the next.
Right. And in a lot of parts, it's almost like one big song.
Yeah, it's like there aren't like musical numbers in this movie, whereas most Disney movies have that, where there's kind of like a showstopper, or even if it's moving the plot along, it's definitely, you know, a song for its own sake.
Yeah, a lot of the songs are already in progress as she comes upon the characters that are singing them.
Right, like you brought up, you know, the Cheshire Cat is kind of just offhandedly singing this bit of Jabberwocky, and I wouldn't even call that a song, it's just kind of something he's singing to himself to kind of, right, you know, announce his entrance, and... Yeah, there's little bits of, like, you know, stuff from the book, little bits of poetry that kind of get turned into throwaway songs, and it's...
Right.
It's much more like a Broadway play, where there's kind of, like, little, you know, incidental bits of songs that aren't full musical numbers, but they kind of move things along and keep the music flowing, which doesn't usually happen in movie musicals, but it's definitely happening in this one.
Right, and there are songs that will be, you know, under a minute long. Like, there's that little... bit that the dodo bird is singing on the Sea of Tears. Tweedledum and Tweedledee have all these short little songs that they start singing that they pick up or drop at different points, and you know, as she wanders away from them, they're starting to sing "You Are Old, Father William," which is of course a song from the book and is one of the poems from the book that is a direct parody of a more moralistic already existing poem.
Yeah. Like there aren't many songs from Alice in Wonderland that sort of, you know, are held up in the Disney musical canon on their own as classics, aside from like the Unbirthday song and maybe Golden Afternoon. Both get like kind of on those like best of Disney compilations or in, you know, Out in the Wild. Other than that, you know, the songs don't really exist outside of the movie.
I think Painting the Roses Red sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah.
That one, again, it's got so much story going on, kind of starting and stopping with dialogue flowing in and out of it, that it's a little hard to extract. But the Unbirthday song has definitely taken on quite a life of its own.
Yeah, but when you consider how, just how much music and songs are going on in this movie that, you know, how many of them are so tightly tied to the movie that they don't really exist or stand on their own, which is kind of unusual for Disney.
Though I understand that the big choral title song that just plays over the title cards at the very beginning became a jazz standard for a little while?
Yeah, that's what I read, but I have not heard such a version. I
was really? Aware of it.
Yeah.
I'm so surprised to hear that.
I would like to hear that. If you guys
look that up before recording,
if you track that down, let me know.
Right.
Yeah,
if we can find it, we'll put it in the show notes. But I've read that, but yeah, cannot confirm that actually happened.
Yeah,
because I've never heard a jazz version of Alice in Wonderland, and that would be so weird as not only a jazz song but as like a popular jazz song.
Yeah,
but
like you'd just be like hanging out in a club in New York in the 50s and. You hear that.
Is it still sung by the Mellow Men?
I don't know.
Great if it was.
Love the Mellow Men.
Yeah.
Who, if it offers me any pedigree for being a part of this, which nothing else does, the Mellow Men was led by Thurl Ravenscroft, who I share a hometown with.
Do
so,
you?
Yes.
Awesome.
So there's my tangential connection to... Alice in Wonderland. Is
well, I should say that's great.
Thank you.
Oh.
And they do the voices of the playing cards that are painting those roses, as mentioned.
Yes. Also famous for being the voices of the chorus in the Haunted Mansion and in the Pirates of the Caribbean and all kinds of Disney stuff.
They're kind of all over the songs in Disneyland.
Yeah, like, is there a chorus of men singing in a Disney product from the 50s or 60s? It's probably the Mellow Men.
I like as just the the voice cast itself for Alice in Wonderland feels very much like a lot of Disney standards of the era have like specifically Edwin and who am I thinking of Sterling Holloway.
Yes, it's kind of an Avengers of
great, yes,
radio personalities and voice actors who were kind of all throughout that era of Disney, but they're all in this one.
Yeah, they reuse a lot of talent during this time, and because they had such great talent to reuse. Yeah, Edwin and Sterling Holloway, like you said, Bill Thompson.
Bill Thompson played both the rabbit and the dodo in this movie, both of which he kind of has those two modes. Like, you hear those two characters in a lot of Disney movies. They don't quite sound the same, but they're all him. Like, you know, there's the white rabbit who sounds exactly like Smee.
Yeah.
And the dodo sounds exactly like Uncle Waldo in Aristocats.
Right.
But, like, those are both the same guy. He's kind of got those two distinct modes.
Right. Verna Felton was also in Sleeping Beauty. She was both Flora and the Queen in that. Sterling Holloway is most famous as Winnie the Pooh.
Again, like Sterling Holloway, it's amazing like how much work he got as so many different iconic characters, because he doesn't really change his voice.
No, he had a very distinctive voice.
Yeah, it's like even if you don't know anything about like Disney or who the voices are, like you'll always be like, oh, it's that guy.
That guy who was the tenor.
It's weird though to think of, you like, oh yeah, Winnie the Pooh and Ka the Snake and the Cheshire Cat are all the same dude, and it just seems weird.
Right. Yeah. Edwin was probably, aside from the Mad Hatter, most famous for appearing in Mary Poppins in a live-action performance. Mm-hmm.
And Edwin's performance was interesting in this movie because, much the same way they would do with Robin Williams 40 years later on Aladdin, they kind of just set up this whole, you know, tea party for him to improvise as the Mad Hatter, passing all this stuff around, which of course they did, as you know, they filmed all the live action reference. This one, I feel like, looking at the kind of bonus materials and stuff, I feel like there's more of it on this one than even any of their other movies.
Yeah,
where, you know, the Disney studio didn't really do like rotoscoping where they shot live action film and traced over it, but they would very, very often have live actors act out what the characters were doing and, you know, watch it back and study it and slow it down and, you know, do all that stuff. And they were doing that, and they had Edwin on stage in this kind of, you know, makeshift Mad Hatter costume, improvising as the Mad Hatter. And then when they went to go record his dialogue proper, they found that the performance wasn't quite as lively and energetic as the fantastic performance he gave when he was just improvising for live action reference. So they actually used that.
Yeah.
So what you hear in the movie is just him improvising on a soundstage. They just used it.
Oh, that's fantastic. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Catherine Beaumont, who was the voice of Alice, was also the live-action reference that they studied from, using a lot of her movements that she would improvise on the stage that they then directly put into the animation. And they did the same with Jerry Colonna, who was one of the most famous comedians of the day, as the March Hare. They use a lot of his expressions and movements.
Yeah, like, but I think it's especially true of like Edwin. Like, you could put Edwin side by side, like a photo or video side by side with the animation of the Mad Hatter, and it's just like, oh yeah, they pretty much cast him and then just built the entire character around him.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
It's an amazing performance.
Yeah, and one image that always sticks out in my head of some of the behind the scenes material I've seen, as far as, you know, without rotoscoping, but at least like filming the actors or what, studying them, was an image of Catherine Beaumont in a little dollhouse. Like, they actually just had her in the dollhouse with her hands and feet kind of sticking out of it.
Yeah,
she was a trooper.
She was, bless her.
And she looked quite a lot like Alice when they would dress her up in that the sort of.
The
iconic
costume.
The iconic costume the blue dress.
Mark Davis, who was the directing animator for most of Alice in most of the sequences, actually was very specific in picking out the reference costume, making sure it was the exact material and also color that he wanted it to be, so that her reference costume would move the way he wanted the animated costume to as much as possible. He actually personally worked with the costumer to design her reference costume.
Yeah, Mark Davis is probably one of those names that we're gonna end up like dropping a lot as we go through the movies from this era, because he was kind of like the big master at that time of just like so many of the great main characters were him. Like, he was the director on Alice. He did both Aurora and Maleficent on Sleeping Beauty, and he designed them as well.
Right. He was great with all the characters that needed a certain gravitas or grace to them.
Yeah.
He was very good at the graceful characters.
And Catherine Beaumont, I was really impressed, again, watching it just last night to prepare for this. And, you know, it hadn't been that long since I'd seen this movie, but there were certain things that struck me, again, analyzing it for this podcast. Like, Catherine Beaumont is really great, and I was wondering, like, you know, how old she was, because it's really hard to place her age.
Yes.
Based on her voice in this movie. And, you know, it's kind of hard to tell from, like, the way she's drawn. Like, you can only kind of nail down Alice as, like, maybe, like a tween. She's, like...
Tween, yeah. In the book, she's specifically 7.5, but clearly animated Alice is not. She definitely has a post-pubescent voice and is a little too tall for a 7.5-year-old.
Right. So I looked it up, and she was 12.
What?
Right? Yeah.
I would not have guessed 12.
No, neither would I. And again, not just because of the you know, sound of her voice, that she sounds very mature, but she also gives a really terrific performance.
Yeah.
There's so much, like... I think Alice is kind of a deceptively difficult character to perform, I would imagine, because there's so much reacting and kind of pretending to be sure of yourself. That's kind of her whole deal of, like, blustering through this crazy wonderland.
Right, and a character who has to be in a bad mood through most of the story, but still has to remain a sympathetic character, even though she's making dumb decisions and is getting mad at people. You still want to be on her side, you know.
Right. So, yeah, she's a very likable performance for, you know, a character whose whole deal is that she's not as smart as she thinks she is, and she kind of offends everybody because she's super insensitive because she's really dumb.
Right. They toned down that aspect from the movie, too. In the book, she's just... There's this string of times where she keeps, like, wanting to make conversation with characters, and she brings up her cat, and she keeps talking about her cat, Dinah, to, you know, creatures that get eaten by cats.
And then gets mad at them for getting offended by... or scared.
Yeah.
By this conversation.
That they're kind of like, oh, I'm uncomfortable, I'm just going to edge away here. And then she gets mad at them. I'm like, wait, come back!
Yeah. But yeah, she's, you know, super charming vocal performance as Alice. And you can kind of see why, you know, Walt just kept her around and just went straight into... she went straight into Wendy in Peter Pan, which was immediately after this. And she, in fact, would go on to voice Alice and Wendy in everything that those characters were required for 50 years. Because, you know, there was, like, the theme park stuff, the, like, cartoons, like, House of Mouse TV show where characters would kind of come and go. The Kingdom Hearts games, she's in that. She officially retired as Alice and Wendy in 2005. So it was over 50 years of her just kind of coming into Disney whenever they needed those two characters for something. And that's really the only acting that she did. She's a teacher, and she kind of just went back to doing that.
Yeah.
She never really became an actress, but she kept playing those two characters.
Aside from these two roles.
These two most iconic roles in movies of the 20th century. And she just kind of kept doing it for a little, you know, whatever one or two sentences those characters needed to say in theme parks or products.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's really incredible. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's very much a who's who of great, mostly comedic vocal talent at the time. And this movie was the first time that they actually advertised a movie based on the strength of the voice cast, where they actually put the cast on the movie poster. that was new.
Yeah, and would remain very unusual for Disney, you know, up to today. Like, they still don't really advertise their voice cast, which is something I give them credit for over, like, you know, DreamWorks, who just literally puts photos of their voice actors on posters sometimes. Yeah, this was an interesting example of they actually advertised the voice cast just straight up.
It's interesting, and that's true. There are certain characters that I forget are celebrities until I go revisit it, as far as like the actors that portray them. Whereas I don't have that problem with a lot of DreamWorks characters, where specifically I picture the actor before I can picture what the character looked like.
Yeah, they'll like, you know, put the voice actors just in the opening credits, you know, as if they're the live action stars of a movie. You know,
right.
Like I said, they'll be on the poster. I remember a Shrek 2 teaser poster that was literally photos of the voice cast. Just stopping in the lobby and staring at it, like, really?
Yeah.
It was like their professional headshots. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, when they leave that out, you get the sense that, you know, they feel that they can sell the movie more on the strength of the story and the visuals and maybe the music and stuff more. Though I think with Alice in Wonderland, there was maybe more of an incentive because there were so many other versions of Alice in Wonderland, you know, just, like, you've kind of got your choice of movies for Alice in Wonderland.
True.
To see, because they've been constantly making them since the beginning of film, and, you know, hey, did you see this story a couple years ago, or maybe just recently in a re-release? Well, this one is going to be different because look at how many people you love are going to be in this one. You want to come see this one too, even if you already saw an Alice in Wonderland movie. I think that's probably what's going on there.
Yeah, definitely that with the added name power of Walt Disney.
Exactly.
And Walt Disney was ultimately not very happy with this movie.
Yeah, the movie comes out in 1951, and I think it was a moderate success. You know, it wasn't the big smash that, you know, that his biggest hits were.
But it was the number two top-grossing movie for that year.
It didn't lose money, but it wasn't like the kind of crowd-pleaser that, you know, Snow White and even Cinderella the year before, which had been their return to form. Coming out of World War II and getting back into making feature films and launching with Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland, one of them needed to be a huge success. There are records and interviews talking about how, like, during production on Cinderella, Walt would go around to the crew and say, like, if this doesn't work, it's the last one. Like, if we don't have a huge success here, we cannot go on, because there was just no money in animation after the war.
Well,
Fortunately, Cinderella was a huge success because it was such a callback to Snow White. It was probably the closest that they had done to just, you know, doing Snow White again.
Right.
Which was what audiences wanted, because Snow White, up to then, had really been the only, like... By this point in the early 50s, the Disney name is synonymous with quality family entertainment, but they haven't really had any actual financial successes since Snow White, because they kept pouring all this money into these crazy expensive ventures. And we talked about this a little bit on our Snow White podcast, about how those next few movies after that are huge artistic successes, and they you know, bound ahead in the art of animation, and audiences liked them, but there was just no way to make money back on how much they were spending, because they weren't really concerned about profits beyond just being able to make the next one.
Right. They were just pouring everything back into advancing the technology of animation and what you could achieve on an artistic level. But Cinderella, you know, came in after the war and had all the elements of a crowd pleaser, so that got some money back in the old Disney coffers.
Yeah, so then Alice in Wonderland comes out, and yeah, it's you know, it has the problem that any adaptation of Alice in Wonderland is gonna have, no matter how good it might be, is that, you know, it's cold. You know, it's an intellectual film that doesn't, you know, the thing Walt didn't like about it is, you know, Walt Disney's whole thing was, you know, reaching for the emotions, and, you know, you have to feel for the characters, and it makes you laugh and cry and sing along, and, you know, no version of Alice in Wonderland is really going to do that.
Right. It's just not in the source material. The source material is all, like, you know, amusing logic puzzles and puns, so very many puns, but the characters are all, like, people not liking each other.
Yeah, like, the Disney version actually goes a long way towards making the characters likable. You read the book and, you know, you don't like anybody in it.
Right.
They're either, you know, obnoxious or scary or gone in two sentences.
Right.
Which is the whole point of the book, and it works great, but it is not a Disney formula at all. And I think it was too late into production of this kind of obligation to do it that Walt, especially, who had that sort of sense of what he wanted out of the story, realized that, you know, there's no way to make Alice in Wonderland into kind of his ideal of what a Disney film
right.
should be. And I definitely feel that. Like, you know, watching it again, you know, there's a lot of great things about it. There's a lot of scenes that, like, you know, look really nice, and there's a lot of cool, you know, songs and stuff. And it's pretty faithful to the book, relatively. And then it just stops, and you kind of, you forget about it as soon as it's over, in a lot of ways. You kind of just wake up from the dream.
Yeah, it doesn't have that emotional impact.
Right.
It certainly has the big, you know, aesthetic impact,
mm-hmm.
but not the emotions. Like, these characters aren't your favorite characters. You don't love them and cherish them, even if you like watching the movie, even if you're laughing at them. The emotional connection isn't really there, because the emotional connection isn't between the characters.
Right. So, Yeah. It was, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. And it's they certainly try at parts. Like, I feel like the biggest emotional moment in the film is that Tolgi Woods scene with Alice, where you're supposed to just really feel for her, that she's kind of gotten herself this far in this bizarre world that she sort of wished to be, and then found out, like, you know, no, nonsense is awful when you're surrounded by it all the time. And then the movie kind of goes back into the stuff with the queen and the trial, and then just everything's chasing you, and then bam, the movie's done, and it doesn't really allow for that. I don't know, you don't really get a catharsis from it, as far as, like, that's the thing that I think I was surprised about the most in rewatching it, which I also have, it's not been that long since I last saw it, and it's certainly a film I've seen many times, but just watching it, you know, to prepare for this podcast, the movie just ends. It's a very bizarre thing to just have, like, here's all these beautiful, strange things happening, and then, well, all right, we're done now. All right, let's go home for tea.
And that's true of a lot of Disney movies, but it tends to usually work kind of to their advantage, that, like, the story wraps up and sends you on your way, you know, when you're on that emotional high. But there's no real emotional high at the end of Alice in Wonderland, because it's a dream.
Right.
She wakes up and it ends. And that whole climax with the trial comes out of nowhere. Like, it's not the end of an arc. It's just kind of a climax, but it's not the climax of anything that you've been led on this journey to.
Right. There's kind of an attempt to give the movie sort of a theme, like you were just saying, Tracy, coming to a head there in the Tolgi Wood, where she's singing a song, she's crying about, you know, how she's lost and she's all alone and she's unhappy being surrounded by the nonsense, and she's chastising herself for not listening to her own good advice, or for, you know, she hears all this good advice and then she doesn't act on it. That's something that's sort of set up and continuing in a couple different points throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of, you know, the only thing we get to a sort of theme going on. And then the Cheshire Cat shows up again, and hey, it's a recurring character, one of the few times a character shows up again. Yay! And she's happy to see him, you know, he's a cat, which she likes. You know, that makes sense, because she's got a cat, he's a cat, she likes cats. And he's like this friend, and he's going to help her out. But then you go into the next sequence, when he shows up again during the croquet game with the Queen of Hearts, and like you just said, we go from this emotional moment, it doesn't really go anywhere. There's no conclusion to these thoughts about taking her own her own good advice.
Yeah.
We just go into another big, albeit awesome, sequence in the maze, the big hedge maze, and
yes.
the march of the cards. And
yeah, that's one of the standout sequences of the movie.
Definitely. Oh, my goodness.
It yeah. is fantastic. But yeah, like I said, the one recurring character, the one real only, in quotation marks, friend she has in the entire story ends up really just kind of setting her up, betraying her, and just being a general a-hole. And right. then...
So it's sort of like, ah, you fool to trust somebody yeah. at all. There are, you know, a couple other times characters recur. Of course, they have it that she's chasing the white rabbit all throughout, so we see him a couple times. But he's not a friend character. You know, he does not like her at all.
He's a MacGuffin.
He's a MacGuffin.
Indeed.
He's an adorable MacGuffin.
Yes.
I really like his character design a lot.
He's much less of an asshole than he is in the book, too.
Yeah.
Although not that much less, I guess.
No, but they just make him kind of more neurotic in the movie, which makes him a little bit more sympathetic. Like, he's not trying to be rude. He's just so, like, anxious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, like happens in the book, the Mad Hatter and... the March Hare. I don't think the March Hare shows up in the trial in the book.
He does. Oh, in the movie. Yeah,
in the movie he yeah. does. I think in the book it's just the Mad Hatter who shows up to give testimony at the trial of the Knave of Hearts, which is Alice's trial in the movie, to keep the focus more on her again.
Right.
But the Mad Hatter, the March Hare, and the Dormouse all show up again at the trial. And the one other time a character shows up, until, of course, the very, very end, where she kind of surreally rushes back through all of the sequences she's been through thus far, is that the dodo bird, who she first sees at the Sea of Tears and the caucus race on the shore, that he shows up in place of Pat the gardener at the White Rabbit's house to burn the house down.
Yeah.
With Alice inside, because she's a monster. So, they tried to give a little bit more follow-through in the movie.
Yeah, there's
a little more flow
here and there.
Sure. Do you think that was for simplistic purposes, or maybe they really liked that actor and thought, well, because he is really great just in that scene of just being that dodo and offering to burn down his house, but
yeah,
right. In the book, the White Rabbit is more taking the lead in that scene, and they wanted somebody who would. In the movie, they sort of changed the White Rabbit so that he's more the straight man to all the nonsense going on. So of course he's not going to burn his own house down. He's the character who's maybe the most sane in this insane world.
Yeah.
So they needed a strong, forceful personality who would take over the scene, and yeah, that the dodo bird works perfectly well, and
again, kind of gives it more of the through line that you need in a more visual medium like a film that you don't necessarily do when you're just reading words on a page.
Right.
Plus,
more than making up a new character.
Right. Plus, you know, you can make up a new character and write a sentence about it. But when you have to put it in an animated movie, there's, you know, designing and animating is
and
so
casting,
extra than casting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so much easier to throw in another appearance by a character we just saw. So probably a couple different motivations for
yeah.
doing that.
Right. The dodo bird is great, too. You know,
yeah.
Pat the gardener doesn't have a personality in the book. And,
no.
you know, they made up this dodo bird who has so much personality, you know, working off of the officious dodo bird in the book and just expanding that out in this wonderful character. So yeah, why not reuse him?
And then Bill the Lizard enters, and the interesting thing about Bill the Lizard is he shows up again 35 years later in The Great Mouse Detective as one of Radigan's henchmen.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
They just took that same model and just put him in the movie. Like, it's they didn't change him at all. It's the same character
right.
in a different movie,
which is wonderful. He also shows up in Who Framed Roger Rabbit holding a ladder.
Right.
Yeah, you can see him very briefly. But of course, that's the cartoon actor who was Bill the Lizard, and
not Bill the Lizard.
Not Bill the Lizard, but it's kind of wonderful that here's the same character model that shows up in two entirely unrelated movies.
Yeah, and it's not just like the throwaway cameo joke like some of the other little appearances in the background. It's like, no, they just needed this guy.
they needed a guy to round out Radigan's gang, so Bill the Lizard. I love it.
Why not?
Yeah, he's got a great look.
They saw his headshots. They were like, yes.
keep the hat.
Right, and, you know, he goes sailing off into the air, and there goes Bill.
There goes Bill.
And we don't know what happened to him, and I guess he landed in London and joined a gang.
Yes.
As you do.
Oh, we should say the other, like, really great character change before we move on is the king.
Oh, yes. I love how they changed the king for this movie. I think he's actually much better and funnier in the movie than he is in the book.
The king is pretty nondescript in the book. He's just kind of there with the queen, and they're both angry. There's not really anything special about him.
He's angry, and but he pardons everybody that the Queen of Hearts sentences to be beheaded. He just, you know, kind of turns around like, you're all pardoned.
Yeah. Of course, in the movie, they went with a great running joke where nobody even notices the king, and the White Rabbit keeps having to say, "And the king."
Hooray!
And yeah, there's that one voice in the back when the king is introduced that goes, "Hooray!"
That's my single favorite moment of the movie, is one person far in the distance cheering for the king.
And he immediately gets stared down by the queen.
Yes.
Whoever that one guy was.
Right. Oh, and I love the character design choice where he's so tiny and they made the queen so enormous. One of my favorite things that can happen in cartoons is when you have characters who are a couple, and preferably a villainous couple, that have wildly disparate sizes to them.
Mm-hmm.
So her being just this enormous force, and that he's this tiny little guy with who's half crown, it's very appealing to me.
Yeah,
I love it. The King of Hearts was voiced by an actor named Dink Trout, which is, like, the best name ever.
Dink Trout. It's the character actoriest name you can basically imagine.
That sounds like the name of the guy who would play this character.
Yeah.
Dink Trout.
I was going to say, that sounds like that could have been that character's name before he was crowned or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
King Dink Trout.
Since I feel like King of Hearts can't be a proper name, it's got to be just a title.
Yeah.
Right.
So. As we were saying, the movie comes out. It's a moderate success. It leaves Walt Disney feeling pretty cold about it. It's the only movie made during his, you know, his period where he is on record as being displeased with it. You know, everyone around him. You know, he didn't talk about it that much, but there's kind of like there are quotes from the other animators and stuff to talk about how he was openly displeased with how you know, how emotionless and hollow it felt, and how it was an appeal to the intellect instead of the mind and the heart, the way that, you know, his preferred movies are.
Right. And it didn't get rave reviews.
No, like, it was kind of just middle of the road.
Yeah. Like the critics weren't crazy about it.
No. In fact, it was the first Disney film to be shown on television just 2 years after it came out. It was the second episode of the Disneyland TV show in 1953. And then they showed it again on TV a few years later. You know, they just kind of started using it as like a testing ground in a lot of ways. I think it was also their first one on Laserdisc later on in the 80s, if I recall.
Hmm.
It was pretty early in their DVD run. It's kind of the movie where it's like they know it's got enough of a following to get attention, but if they screw something up, it's not like they've, you know, ruined one of their big classics.
It's like the one they feel a little bit expendable about.
Right. So it you know, kind of just floats along for a while. In the 60s, it becomes available. It's their first movie to become available as a 16mm film rental, when that became a thing, that you could just rent film reels and project them in your home.
And then it became a huge success.
Because the 60s! the fact that you could acquire a reel of Alice in Wonderland and project it in like a college dorm room in the 60s.
Right. You could rent it, you know, to view at home or on a campus or at a party or in a club.
Yeah, so
that was very popular
as the,
in the 60s.
As the drug culture ramps up, there start to be reports of like campus parties where Alice in Wonderland just plays on a loop on a projector all weekend.
just on a loop.
You know, then you know the Jefferson Airplane song "White Rabbit" comes out and kind of, you know, is a huge hit, such a huge hit that sort of repopularizes the Alice in Wonderland imagery, and it's tied to the drug culture. And then Disney gets the idea to put it back out there again. I think that was the first time it had been re-released since 51, was in the mid-60s.
Right. Well, I mean, they were initially kind of resistant to the idea of encouraging the college kids to be getting too excited about this movie, but then they're like, wait, we're gonna make like so much money.
Yeah, and it's that those years immediately after Walt died where they really started to lean on their catalog because, you know, they was all they had for a while.
Right.
And they had the idea to try,
and they needed the cash
to try putting out especially Alice in Wonderland and Fantasia. Obviously for obvious reasons, both became kind of known as this new kind of Disney release, and they had promotional campaigns that really encouraged it after a while. Like, there's a poster for Alice in Wonderland from like 68 or whatever, and that it's got like, you know, Alice sitting on a mushroom is the central image, and it's got this like kaleidoscope of psychedelic colors, and the tagline on the poster says, "Should you see it, go ask Alice." that becomes this huge cult film in the late 60s and into the 70s. And it sort of slowly, gradually finds its way into like public acceptance as a classic in the way that a lot of the underappreciated Disney movies of the early era did. You know, like Fantasia, again, no one knew what to make of that until the 60s, and then it kind of just blossomed from there into being hailed as a masterpiece.
Right. And as time went on and there was some distance, this film did start to come to be regarded as one of the better of the many, many adaptations of the book as well.
Yeah, because like I said, it's surprisingly faithful. The only reason it feels wrong is because it doesn't really feel like a Disney movie in a lot of ways. And I think, again, with the distance thing, if you watch a bunch of Disney movies in a row, if you like kind of go through the catalog, as we're obviously doing right now, it's actually kind of refreshing to have one that feels that different at this point in the game. That, you know, it doesn't follow that Disney formula of kind of appealing to the heart and the feels. And while that maybe seemed like a weakness at the time, taken on its own as the new Disney movie, it kind of gives it something that stands apart from all the other Disney movies and gives it very much its own identity that I think is really refreshing when you actually sit and watch it now.
Yeah, especially now that, you know, there's a wealth of animated movies throughout the history of the medium, and so many of them, I'd say, you know, the overwhelming majority of them are really trying to hit you in the emotions. It's, yeah, like you said, it's refreshing that here's one that is so different, that stands out so much, and is this, you know, wonderful, more intellectual, and incredibly modernist movie.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it's that thing where, like, you know, the kind of, that modernist style is much easier to appreciate now than I'm sure it was at the time when it was this weird new thing, and now it's like this, now it's retro.
Yeah.
And it's really cool.
Now you can see where that style fits in illustration history.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's always really interesting to me when, I don't know, things that are hailed as classics, you come to realize was very much not the case in its time. And I always wonder about stuff like that, like what will be the thing that, like, you know, in another 10 years down the road, are they going to hail Home on the Range as a forgotten Disney classic or something like that? Like,
indeed.
Right, like Home on the Range did not get a very different reception to, you know, some of the stuff from this era.
Right,
that,
like,
later went on to be.
How is that going to be viewed in the future?
And then, of course, it really became sort of this, like, sub-brand within Disney. Like, you know, there's an Alice in Wonderland franchise.
As they like stepped up more of the Disney product marketing machine.
There's kind of the specific, this entire corner of it that's Alice in Wonderland, the same way there's a corner of it that's like Winnie the Pooh.
Right. A corner that's just princesses.
Where there's this niche that's like its own thing within the thing. Of course, the theme parks help a lot with that because Alice in Wonderland is just all over the damn place in the theme parks.
Right.
It's the only movie that has two permanent attractions.
Yeah.
Side by side.
Side by side. And the costumed characters are very...
They're always very, very popular. No matter
where
you go.
Yeah.
You know, there's both the teacups, which of course are the like one of the iconic images of Disneyland, is the teacup ride. And the dark ride, which is popular for, like we said, it's really just feels like being in the movie more than even most of those dark rides do.
Right. And a few years ago at Disneyland, there was a stage show they were doing for a while.
I'm sure.
That was with a rock band. It was called the Mad Tea Party, like the letter T. And the band members kind of dressed in sort of like rave interpretations of Alice in Wonderland characters, like the Hatter and the Cheshire Cat and the Dormouse and the March Hare. And there was some kind of rock band stage show to appeal to the teens, I imagine.
Yeah.
I haven't, you know, seen the show. I just kind of am aware that this thing existed.
Yeah, it's kind of this thing where, you know, at some point in the last, you know...
I don't know if it still exists.
At some point in the last, like, 30 years or so, Disney realized that, you know, they have this thing that is both, you know, one of their properties and a well-known literary property. So it's kind of got this, like, built-in fan base to it, and they really realized the potential of kind of taking advantage of that and turning it into a brand.
And one that, like we said, appeals to sort of an alternative crowd in a way that most of their other properties don't.
A lot of people who kind of rebel against, like, the sweetness of, you know, Snow White and Cinderella will flock to the weirdness and the intellectualism of something else, Wonderland.
Right. And the way that it has sort of a sinister edge. You know, Alice in Wonderland is a book that is really popular for people to reinterpret in, like, dark, edgy kind of way.
Yeah.
For the goth teens.
Exactly.
Everything is violence. Let's make it sexy and dark.
Yeah.
Cue the Tim Burton film.
Exactly.
Indeed.
So yeah, even then, like, there's other Alice in Wonderland Disney stuff that is not directly springing from this movie. There's the Tim Burton movie in 2010, which
is not good.
The weird thing about that is it kind of poses itself as a sequel to the original story, and kind of a sequel to this movie specifically, being both Disney, but that was live action.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I feel like Tim Burton had the same thing that Walt Disney did, where, like, people were saying, like, oh, when's Tim Burton going to do an Alice in Wonderland movie for 20 years? And finally, in this last decade where Tim Burton has kind of just started doing what's expected of him, he eventually got to Alice in Wonderland, and it's...
Right. The big problem with that movie, not to go off on too much of a tangent, I'm sorry, the big problem with the Tim Burton movie is that it tries to make sense out of Wonderland.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got this, like, war plot, which is another thing a lot of Alice in Wonderland, you know, spin-off fiction does, where it's, like, tries to frame it as, like, a war for Wonderland, where they, like, have different factions that the characters are joining. It's like that just completely destroys...
And they keep trying to say, you know, like, oh, no, Alice, when you were here when you were a child, you were just misunderstanding all of this stuff that's actually perfectly logical.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait, no, isn't that kind of taking away from the inherent appeal of Alice in Wonderland, is that none of this stuff actually means anything? It's just an excuse to make puns.
Right. But yeah, that movie is a mess, and it's Tim Burton's worst movie. It's got a couple things in it that are nice.
It's got some stuff that make me really want to like it. It's got Crispin Glover. Oh, Crispin Glover.
There's some nice design elements, but they're being executed with that kind of not very good CGI.
It has Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee, that's great.
He's the Jabberwock.
Yeah.
It's... I want to love that, but that movie's such a mess.
I thought the lead was very charming as well.
The whole cast
is
good.
It's a great cast.
You've got, you know.
It's a great cast in a stupid story
Alan
that
Rickman.
that misunderstands the inherent appeal of Alice in Wonderland.
I think if Tim Burton had just done a remake of Alice in Wonderland, like just done his own adaptation of the book, he could have had something there.
Yeah.
But that story is just a mess.
It's also very drab looking in contrast to how beautiful and colorful the animated film is.
Exactly. It's got this really, really weird look to it.
Yeah.
Disney also had the Adventures in Wonderland TV series in the late 80s, early 90s. Jojo and I talked about that the other day. She just barely remembered it once I said it.
Yeah, I have only the very vaguest of memories.
Do you remember
of this
that
show
at all, Tracy?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, it was the late 80s, early 90s. I caught it on the Disney Channel, you know, in the early 90s when I was like 5, 6, 7 years old. I don't know if that was like its original run, if it was on any other like Saturday morning stations, like a lot of other Disney Channel stuff was at the time. But yeah, it was a live action Alice in Wonderland show where Alice was like this, you know, preteen 90s kid who would like step through her mirror and just go hang out in Wonderland every week. And it was kind of just be like little formulas like the caterpillar would always have, you know, some kind of story that'd be told in cartoon form that kind of had a moral to it that was like relevant to Alice's, you know, problem that week. Like, it was kind of like one of those shows where it's like Alice has like a real life problem and, you know, it's dealt with in the she goes to Wonderland to get advice. Tweedledee and Tweedledum were rapping twins. One of them was played by the guy in Back to the Future, Marvin Berry, the guy who yells, "Chuck, it's your cousin, Marvin Berry." There were a lot of characters were puppets.
I have only the vaguest memory. However, from my childhood, I do remember two other Alice in Wonderland adaptations very clearly. One of them, it was live action. I saw it on TV. I don't know if it was a movie or a miniseries, but it scared the heck out of me because it had Gene Wilder playing the Mock Turtle. And I am terrified of Gene Wilder. So Gene Wilder as... it's like Gene Wilder's head on like a turtle body, and he's kind of whimpering in this weird, horrible Gene Wilder way, and that scared me very much. And I have very vivid memories of the Care Bears in Wonderland. Did you see the Care Bears in Wonderland?
I don't remember that at all, no.
I don't remember that. I do remember seeing Gene Wilder, and I've now Googled this Adventures in Wonderland TV show, and I did see that, because I'm seeing, like, the white rabbit with weird, like, you see his human face inside of the rabbit face.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, there were a lot of characters like that. The caterpillar's the same way. It's like a dude in a giant caterpillar suit with his painted face sticking out the front of it.
Oh, my goodness.
The queen was very much, I don't know who the actress was, but she was very much like an Aretha Franklin type. Like, she would have, like, a big soul number every now and then. Yeah, it's one of those shows that, like, it's buried in my mind, like, very, very specifically, but I don't think about it. And then like, every couple of years I'll remember it and I'll be like, oh, man. So we'll have to find some clips from that online, I think, and link to it in the show notes.
The great legacy of Alice in Wonderland.
I think a lot of people in their 20s right now, their like late 20s, early 30s, saw that and have repressed it. It'll come flooding back if you watch a clip.
I am one of those 30-year-olds. Oh man, this is twice you've done this to me in this show, is dug up some Alice in Wonderland related repressed memory.
So yeah, I think the interesting thing about the legacy of this movie is, you know, it's this omnipresent brand within the Disney brand, and the Alice characters are everywhere to the point that these characters have kind of become the public consciousness versions of the Lewis Carroll stories.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, when you think of Alice in Wonderland, if you're anyone who's grown up over the past 50 years, you think of the Disney version.
Right. You think of this and maybe also the original Tenniel illustrations,
right,
which, like I said, are such well-known illustrations that even they cannot be fully surpassed by the Disney version.
Yeah. And, you know, in many ways, it's kind of a shame, because I feel like the book doesn't actually get read that much anymore. Like, a lot of people think they know it, because the story and the Disney stuff is so present that you don't actually go back and read it, because you think you know it. But
right.
It's it's really refreshing to read it. Like I said, I read it for the first time in probably over a decade, just a couple days ago, and it's surprising how well it holds up to a modern audience. Like, I would read this to a kid, and I think they would enjoy it.
Oh, now. Yeah. We will link to the full text in the show notes, because it's public domain, so it's easily accessible. Everybody go read it. It took me, like, an hour, so... Yeah.
It's clever. There's like, legitimately good wordplay that holds up in a way you wouldn't expect. Like, you know, someone in their 20s and 30s in the U.S. reading a book from the 1800s written by a British person, that the wordplay actually is funny.
Oh, there's so many puns.
And lots of really clever stuff, like, you know, when everyone needs to get dry, so the mouse starts telling the most boring story he can imagine.
That's probably my favorite part of the book, is that pun that to dry them off, the mouse starts to tell the driest thing he can think of, which is the history of William the Conqueror, which in the movie is the first thing you hear, because it's that passage that Alice's sister is reading to Alice and Alice isn't paying attention to. That is word for word what the mouse starts reciting in the book.
You should read that. And, you know, Lewis Carroll, a.k.a. Charles Lutwidge Dodson, was an interesting guy whose life is well-documented because he kept, like, very intricate diaries and correspondence. Interesting because he was a clergyman and a professor of mathematics that, you know, the thing he would become legendary for is just this book where the entire point is to appeal to a childish sense of nonsense.
Right. The Victorian times, everybody was full of, you know, repressed shit.
Right. And of course it was written famously for, you know, a real little girl named Alice and her siblings that he would hang out with, who were the children of the dean at the college where he taught. There's, of course, lots of, you know, people who like to make everything edgy, who like to speculate and read, like, really weird stuff into, you know, Dodgson's relationship with these little girls.
Yeah,
I think everything around him is so well documented. Like, there's so much about the little family and him and their interactions and what family friends they were. Like, if anything weird had been going on, it would not have been missed.
Right.
I think it's pretty innocent, really.
I think so, though. You know, it is. That's not coming from nowhere. There are three things that are, you know, fueling that. One is that it was just the Victorian times, and, you know, sexual abuse of children was actually a huge problem then, right? Because, like I said, everybody was super, like, repressed and hypocritical, especially about sexual stuff at the time.
Right.
Another thing is that, you know, he was intimate friends with this family for a while, and then there was a breaking off pretty abruptly, because there was a bunch of gossip going around about his relationship with the family, though none of the gossip was about him and Alice. There was some speculation that maybe he was, you know, hanging out with these kids because he was having an affair with their governess.
Right.
There was some speculation. There was a note written that was passed between some family members about the events that references gossip about him and Lorena, which could mean one of two people. It could mean Alice's older sister, that, you know, he was maybe a little too close with her, and people thought there was, you know, he was maybe making some designs on this family he would not have pretensions to. But Lorena was also the name of the girl's mother, so there, you know, it could also mean that there was some gossip about him being too close with this married woman. So that was one of the things. The other piece of information that kind of adds to that whole debate is that Dodgson, in addition to being a great writer, was also a very prolific photographer. Mm-hmm. He did lots of portraits, and as was not actually uncommon for the time, a lot of his portraits were of children, and some of them were portraits of children in various states of undress, which was kind of a thing that was going on in Victorian art at the time. It was a time of, you know, really prioritizing the innocence of children. And so, you know, nude children showing up in art as a symbol of innocence was not a super weird thing necessarily at the time, because it would be symbolic of innocence. And it is very well documented that he always took photos of children with their parents right there.
Yeah.
But there's, yeah, so there's some speculation. There's no allegations that I'm aware of or speculation that he ever actually, you know, abused any kids. Just that he maybe had some feelings he never acted on. He never got married, and of course that adds to speculation about him being not so great a guy, but that's unfair.
Yeah. I've also heard there's also a substantial amount of speculation that he may have been asexual.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's probably far more likely, is just, you know.
Yeah. And asexuality is something that's frequently misunderstood and not discussed. So it certainly leaves open room for some of those stranger interpretations.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of times in absence of any kind of evidence of a relationship, people will look at that and assume that there must be some kind of, like, relationship that is too horrible to talk about, instead of just that, well, maybe this person just didn't have any of those kind of relationships.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I said, like, his correspondence and the way he lived his life and his diaries are all so well documented that, you know, evidence kind of mounts more towards him just having no interest in any kind of romantic or sexual activity or relationships, because we know a lot about him, and it just, there's not really any evidence there.
Right.
To suggest anything sinister.
The other big, I guess I'll call it a myth about Alice in Wonderland and about Dodgson is drug use. Mm-hmm. That these books are about drugs, and of course that was part of why it was so big in the 60s, is, you know, there's so much people eating and drinking things that change them,
or
yeah, that change them throughout the book, you know, the eat me, drink me, the mushroom especially, and that the caterpillar is smoking on a hookah. So a lot of people are like, ah, drugs. But there's no evidence that that was part of Dodgson's life at all. Even if there was any, you know, kind of a reference to people smoking opium through hookah, which was something people did at the time. Right. It was perfectly legal. It would be more him including that as a maybe a satirical aspect to, you know, make a joke about other people who were doing that right. He was not. There's no evidence whatsoever that he partook of such things himself. This is, I'm sorry, people. Some people do just actually have an imagination. I feel a little bit bitter about that, because when I do art events, people will come up and see my paintings and ask me what I was on, and it gets kind of insulting. So that's something I feel a little personally strong about.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I think anyone who's ever had dreams knows they often don't adhere to any internal logic, certainly. And why should Alice's this dreamlike wonderland, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff she approaches in it, but that's, like, maybe that's just because it's fun, imaginative, interesting. Right, right. Yeah,
and especially because in the books, you know, both narratives are shown very explicitly to be dreams.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's going to write them so that they follow kind of dream logic and just sort of melt from scene to scene, especially in Through the Looking Glass.
And that they, you know, the origin of the stories is that he was just making them up as he went along on picnics.
Yeah.
With these kids. And then they begged him to write them down, so he did. Like, you know.
Right. Well, like, improving them and adding extra jokes and poems and stuff.
But they very much, you know, adhere to that. Like, well, he's just making up a story as he goes, throwing in stuff that would enchant children.
Right.
It's not going to hold up a lot of you know, internal logic because of that.
People like to look for logic and explanations and things.
Right. And I feel like
they sure do.
The entire story is kind of a reaction to that mindset that, like, it's just spoofing, you know, pieces of literature that are there to be metaphors, and
yeah. Right.
That he just wanted to react to that with something that, like, defies analysis.
Yeah.
So getting back to how I started this tangent, the interesting thing about the legacy of this movie, that it has become so prevalent and kind of displaced the book in the public consciousness, and it's everywhere in the theme parks and on Disney merchandise and stuff. But I feel like the movie itself is actually not, you know, that well remembered. Like, necessarily in, like, you know, in terms of opinion, but, like, if you ask the average person, you know, they might think they remember it, but they can't really recall that many scenes from it. And that's kind of my feeling, is I always feel like it always feels like it's been a while since I've watched it, even if it hasn't. Because it just doesn't stick with you.
Right, because it's so disjointed that you can't really follow, like, this scene happened, and then it was this scene.
That, like, it's thought of as, like, a great, you know, Disney property, but it's not really thought of as, like, a great Disney film where people, like, quote it and sing the songs all the time the way they do with the other, you know, classics.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting, kind of the public opinion of this movie.
Right. Except for the On Birthday song and, right. you know, some of the stuff that's just kind of in consciousness because it's a popular book. Or if you're in my family, lots of quoting of the whole croquet scene because my family plays croquet. Yes.
So, yeah, I think it's got a really unique and interesting legacy in that way, that it's become such a brand, kind of more than a film at this point.
Yeah, I always wonder when I see all the t-shirts and merch things in Hot Topic stores or whatever, and, like, how many of the people wearing those things are really that into the movie, or just sort of, yeah, the iconography and what their version of the movie that's in their heads, or what they think that stuff means to them, versus, yeah, just genuinely being a fan of the film. Like, any, the same judgment that I apply to any young person I see wearing a Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd t-shirt.
Yeah, where, like, that thing has become a fashion label independent of the thing that it's actually representing.
Right.
Yeah.
When you see, you know, like, teens today wearing, like, a CBGB shirt. Right. Like, do you...
What is your frame of reference there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that feeling.
Yeah, and I, for a time, I would have applied the same thing to Tinkerbell from Peter Pan, but she's got spin-off movies and a whole other thing there, so I'll allow that. But as far as, yeah, like, the Disney interpretations of the Alice characters it seems very much, yeah, just an existence as a brand more than any, you know, like, if you're wearing a Aladdin t-shirt, I assume it's you're generally a fan of the movie. It's not something that you see people just wear as a fashion statement.
Right. Right. Like, I don't get the feeling from looking at merchandise that there's, like, a wing of the company that's, you know, in charge of the Aladdin franchise that, you know, produces waves of merchandise. It's, right. like, part of a larger Disney line of, like, here's stuff representing our classic movies. Whereas Alice in Wonderland, it's, like, that is a steady, consistent brand of stuff all its own that comes out, and, as you know, you can find it on anything.
Right.
Yeah.
And has been for some time, too.
Yeah. When we went to Disneyland on our honeymoon, we bought a pack of little coasters with the original Tennille illustrations on them. It was like a $2 pack of little coasters, and we went to bring it to the gift shop. We brought it up to the register at the gift shop in the park, and the cashier said, "Would you like a tea set with that today?" And motioned to this, like, you know, $100, you know, complete, you know, pot and cups.
Right.
And
it was like
tray.
A china tea set that had Tennille's illustration of the Mad Tea Party on it.
Wow.
Which I would have loved to have bought if we had a spare $100 and a way to get it from California to North Dakota without breaking.
But yeah, just this, the weirdest upsell I've ever been offered. Like, oh, you're buying a $2 set of coasters. Do you want this $100 set of china?
To go with it? To go with them. They were little, like, paper coasters, too.
Yeah.
That is impressive, and I'm surprised that they have merchandise that has the Tennille illustrations on it.
Yeah, that's
well, they certainly did at the time, because it was 2010, so there was extra push on Alice in Wonderland stuff in the parks at the time, because the Tim Burton movie had just come out, so they were doubling down on Alice in Wonderland stuff throughout the park.
But yeah, that's kind of part of why we grabbed it right away. It was like, oh, it's actual like book illustration merchandise. That's cool. Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm always like that whenever I see Winnie the Pooh merchandise that's actual book illustration Pooh versus animated Pooh.
Right.
And that's definitely another case, and we'll obviously talk more about that on the two Winnie the Pooh podcasts we'll have to do, where that has just morphed into something entirely different in the public conscious than what it actually is.
Yeah, very much so. Anything else you want to say before we go to the old question bag?
I think we probably covered it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, no. So, I got the inbox here.
All right, so let's go to our email.
We have one question this week from Bree Smith, who is Sugar Apple Sweet on Tumblr. And she says, I've always loved the books since they were read to me by my grandmother, as well as later being required reading in high school. White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane was even my favorite song as a child, which I'm sure just thrilled my mother to no end. Sarcasm. Despite the plethora of problems with Tim Burton's take on the world, it was at least memorable. My question, though, is more of wanting to know what you all thought of the Disney version's style. Although I've watched it many times and even watched it again before this email, it really never sticks in my mind for long. It's like they didn't take any serious risks with the style in terms of the character designs. Am I alone in thinking that Disney missed an opportunity to play around outside of their signature look of the time? And that is a great question, and we didn't really talk about the character designs a whole lot.
No,
so,
we didn't.
Tracy, you want to start off?
I think it's probably pretty fair to say. I mean, you definitely see a lot of signature Disney looks in the characters, especially the characters of that era. And as we sort of mentioned before, like the Tennille book illustration style was not in any way kind of applied to it. I don't know. Yeah, I guess I would say they don't take a lot of terrible risks with the design. I think there's a lot of very fun designs, but they're very Disney designs.
Yeah. Yeah. Risky is not really the word for the character designs, although I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, considering that the story is so risky.
Had to be grounded here for the audience.
There has to be something that we can look at it and kind of easily understand what we're seeing.
And yeah, it's not going as over the top or interesting or experimental as you might like an Alice in Wonderland movie to go. There are some really nice touches in some of the character designs, though. Like, I know last night when we were watching it, Jojo, you commented on, like, the Mad Hatter's sleeves and the March Hare's sleeves.
I really like their sleeve length.
Like, they're wearing clothes that aren't quite the right size.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's this kind of small touch to add to the idea that they're both kind of unwell in the head. You know, they're a very gentle kind of mad people. You know,
yeah, they're not nearly as ominous as they are in certain versions of the story.
Right, they're very non-threatening characters. Which is nice, you know. It's kind of nice to have a sequence that's less threatening than the other ones. They have no designs at, you know, killing her or anything.
Right.
And that sequence is very fun. Yeah, but you can see sort of a pretty standard way of drawing like cartoony human faces in the more human characters kinda at the time.
I think that the Hatter at least takes a certain amount of inspiration from the Tennille illustrations, where the kind of proportions,
yes,
got that giant head on a little body, which is kind of the whole thing.
Yeah, you also see kind of similar facial stylings in Cinderella too, with some characters like the dog who turns into a footman, you know, like characters like that. Yeah, he kind of has that same sort of look to him.
Over these two movies are sort of settling into the 50s Disney house style that sort of would be around until Sleeping Beauty, when things got really radical again.
Right. Yeah.
But they are definitely Disney characters. Like there are certain touches here and there that are very unique to this movie, but they don't stray outside the realm of the Disney house style.
Yeah. Alice looks a lot like Cinderella does, you know, very, very smooth, big blue eyes.
Blonde,
yeah. But of course she looks very much like Tennille's illustration.
Yeah, she does.
But the way that her face is treated with very kind of a minimalist, more realistic look against all the more cartoony characters. I've always felt that the March Hare's design could have, I don't know, been something a little more.
Could have done more.
Yeah, I don't know what's missing from his design, but I feel like something is.
I do love his eyes and eyebrows, though.
Yes.
Yeah, he's got like googly eyes that roll around in his head like Cookie Monster.
who's
Dinah?
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, they kind of could have maybe pushed that aspect of his character more of where the phrase "mad as a March hare" is coming from is, you know, because
he's really horny.
That he's horny because March is the hare's mating season, and so they get rambunctious around that time.
I do really like the way that mouths are drawn and animated on a lot of these characters, like the Queen of Hearts and Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and specifically the doorknob.
Yeah, I was gonna say the keyhole that is a mouth is some really smart character animation.
Yeah,
that's really neat. I like the way that moves and doesn't look weird and reads as like a really cool, unique design.
Yeah, that's really impressive. That's wonderful. I love all the designs of the Garden of Live Flowers.
There's some really clever stuff in there of, you know, making little bits of plant life look human. Like when the little kind of sprig is the one flower, the snooty flower's glasses.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of one of those little curly sprigs that's kind of
the iris has a little like opera glasses that are made out of a tendril, and for some characters the petals are forming like hair and their faces on the underside. For other characters the center of the flower is where their face is. There's a lot of variety that's really nice there.
Yeah, they didn't just slap a cartoon face on a flower. They tried to work in the petals and different, yeah.
Yeah, it's very organic.
And the cards are some beautiful character animation.
Move amazingly. Like that sequence is such a standout just on its own, just visually as a piece of art.
Oh, man, yes. Dancing. That's a real like triumph of complicated animation. I love the oysters, the way that they're designed with their little...
They make them so cute and sympathetic.
They're devoured. Yeah, but I love the way that, you know, the shells are forming, like, little bonnets, and that they're running around with their little skirts, and they have no feet, but they have little empty, you know, shoes that look like tiny, tiny conch shells that are, like, trotting along underneath their little skirts.
Yeah.
That's really cute.
Not connected by any legs, they're just, there.
Just floating. I love that.
I always found that sequence very disturbing, because they make them so cute, and they spend so much time in that little song.
Oh, it's incredibly disturbing.
The oysters lovable, and children, that they are babies.
Yeah, they're babies.
And they are eaten alive.
I'm just saying, you know, in general, I like their designs. Yes. And that the mother oyster, that she has a big nose that's a pearl.
Yeah.
That's good. Great. And I adore all the creatures in the Tolchi Wood, which are not from the book at all, but are very much in the spirit of the book. They're sort of a visual interpretation of the kinds of linguistic jokes and nonsense that the book is full of, but here making something new that will work specifically in a visual medium.
Yeah, the bird that is a pair of eyeglasses, and the bird that is a mirror.
Yeah.
And the way they fly together.
And they
at
work.
Alice.
Yeah, they work together.
To make a face.
The bird that is a bird cage that swallows two smaller birds, and
yes.
then they're in the cage flying around, and the umbrella vultures.
Yeah.
I love all those, and the little they're like bicycle horns that are kind of like ducks and kind of like platypi.
Yeah.
Those are cute. I love all of those. All of those are just awesome, awesome character designs.
What about the Cheshire Cat? We had to talk about that earlier.
Yeah. I'm really glad they decided to give him flat teeth instead of sharp, pointy ones.
And I like when they work like a harmonica.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's fun.
The animation on him is fantastic. And I love the decision to make him this strange fluorescent pink and purple combination.
Yeah, that really stood out to me, especially again watching it now on Blu-ray, that he is so like vibrant, hot pink and purple. It's like those colors were not anywhere in 1951. That was such a daring choice.
It was, and I love that it's so otherworldly and weird. I'm not otherwise crazy about his character design, though. I love the way he moves, but just the design itself. There's two things I don't like about that. One is that he's got tiny little ears that are together on the very top of his tiny cranium, and so I don't think he looks very much like a cat, because his ears have kind of disappeared, and then he's got this big nose with really wide nostrils on the front of his face, and it's not like a cat nose at all, so I don't think he reads very much as a cat at all. And then I don't like the way his head is different colors than his body, which is maybe just, you know, like the thought there was legibility, but that,
yeah, it's really weird that, you know, they've got those two bright bold colors in stripes all the way down his body, and then they pick two more that are just slightly off shades for his head.
Right, his head is kind of more right. more desaturated colors. It's like a maroonish kind of color, and then his giant jowls are kind of a less saturated pink. It's a little bit more of an orangey pink.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There's something in that that's not super appealing to me. But he moves so nicely. I love it when he uses his tail to like pick up his scalp and ears and tips it like it's a hat.
And I think the funniest shot in the movie is when he, during like the quick cutting back and forth in the conversation where she's asking about the rabbit, and there's that one cut where it just cuts back to him, and he's like leaning back with his like arms and legs sprawled out, and he's got this like wall-eyed expression where his eyes aren't even focusing, and he's like, what rabbit?
Yes.
It's so funny.
And like it kind of cuts back and forth, and he's in a different like pose
yeah.
every time, like something radically different, and the way his front paws and his back paws kind of interchangeably are all hands doing different things.
Yeah. There's a good reason that the couple of the scenes with the Cheshire Cat are kind of the ones that are the most iconic, I think. That, like, the interactions between Alice and the cat are, you know, really, really fun in the acting, both vocally and animation-wise. Like, the cat was, the director was Ward Kimball on the cat. We've got a list pulled up here.
Let
if we
me
did
see.
What.
It was...
John Lounsbery.
John Lounsbery did the cat, the flowers, and the strange creatures. He was the lead on those.
Yeah, Ward Kimball and John Lounsbery, I think, really headed kind of the animation team in terms of setting the tone of the character animation.
Right. Ward Kimball worked on Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and the Walrus, and the Carpenter, and that sequence, the Mad Hatter, and the
and
White
Rabbit.
The bouncy characters.
Most of the major characters, really.
Yeah.
And Lounsbery was the flowers and the cat and strange creatures, according to the credit that we're looking at here.
Yeah, which be,
and
like, I guess anything across the
movie.
The
two of them, their kind of whole deal is that they were the funny guys of those nine old men of the original animators that, like, you know, they were just like madcap slapstick whenever they were kind of let loose on a character. And the two of them kind of set the tone for the movie, I think, because they were doing so many of the main characters.
Right.
And everyone else kind of followed suit. But yeah, the design, I think the places where the movie really does have ambitious and interesting designs are not the characters, like we discussed, but it's in the colors and the kind of production design of the backgrounds and the layouts. You know, there's some really exciting, interesting things that are very unique to this movie happening back there.
Yeah, stuff you did not see in movies or in cartoons for the most part. You know, you were starting to see some of these kind of designs in short animation, you know, right. Like the Chuck Jones and Maurice Noble Looney Tunes shorts, you know. Yeah. You'd see some of those modernist things coming through.
It was just a little thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, it's very daring for a feature.
So yeah, it is exciting and ambitious and unique in its overall production design, but that doesn't really extend to the characters. The characters are definitely Disney characters. And I feel like they maybe are a little more grounded than they maybe would have otherwise been if this movie had come out at a different period in the company's history, whereas
sure.
coming straight out of World War II with so much writing on these first couple movies being successful, the entire company would have to shut down. I think, you know, they wanted to make sure it was still a Disney movie.
Right. They didn't want to lose the audience in the weirdness.
Yeah. And I know it's been well documented that certain story changes in the next couple movies after this happened to kind of bring things back down, because Alice in Wonderland was such a kind of got such a tepid reaction that it really made them even more afraid to take chances on things throughout the 50s. So we will discuss that on other podcasts.
Yes.
Yes. You see how I wrap things up there?
Well done. That was good. It was good podcasting. And any last remarks on Alice in Wonderland, Tracy?
It is a film that I don't know. It's always been one that I have enjoyed coming back to versus others of this era for whatever part. Like, I've probably rewatched Alice more than Cinderella, definitely more than even Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm.
And probably just for the, I don't know, the uniqueness of it versus its other Disney contemporaries. And something that I think probably it just appeals more as a fan of the whimsical and as a cartoonist, maybe even. I'm glad that it found its place, even though the place that it found is kind of bizarre considering. but it is good that it does have the appreciation that it has.
Yeah, agreed.
I think we agree.
Positive feelings about Alice in Wonderland. Fan as a cartoonist, as an artist.
And as someone who enjoys Disney movies, like I said, it's nice to have kind of a breath of fresh air when a lot of them sort of blend together if you look at them all at once. Yeah. And this one definitely still stands out.
Yeah, it's like it's not at the top of the list, but it's always a pleasant surprise. Always pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, Tracy, do you want to let people know where they can find you online?
Absolutely. You can find me most anywhere as Mockingbird. Spelled Mauking Bird, because I'm being clever with how my last name is spelled and pronounced.
Ho ho, Lewis Carroll would be proud.
Oh, I hope so.
You would be a told you were a creature.
I Mockingbird. And that includes Twitter and Tumblr, my long neglected DeviantArt, and just about anywhere else. You can find me under that name.
Well then, thank you, Tracy, and a very merry unbirthday to you.
A merry, merry unbirthday. And to you as well. Yo.
And so we find ourselves once again by our computer, as if perhaps this podcast was all a dream.
Thanks once again to our special guest, Tracy Mock. Everyone, search for her on the internet to find all of her good stuff. Look for Mockingbird, M-A-U-K, Ingbird.
Just a reminder that JoJo was a guest on the latest episode of our friend Dylan Roth's Supers on Screen podcast, talking about the 2002 Spider-Man film, along with fellow guest Dominic Griffin. You should go check that out at deadshirt.net. Tracy is also a frequent guest on that show, and I've been on it before. JoJo will also be heard on another Deadshirt podcast coming up, the new Bond Girls.
I will be on the second episode of Bond Girls discussing From Russia with Love.
That's the new podcast hosted by Christina Harrington, where ladies sit around and talk about 007. It's a great time. You should check that out. Please join us again in 2 weeks when we will be taking a look at a much more recent film, 2012's Wreck-It Ralph.
We're gonna wreck it!
We sure are.
And if you have any questions about Wreck-It Ralph for us to discuss on the show, please email them to disneydissected@gmail.com.
And as always, please make sure you're following the podcast Tumblr, disneydissected.tumblr.com. That's where you'll find new episodes going up every other Thursday. You'll also find show notes, links to stuff we talk about, things like that. You can follow both of us on Twitter and Tumblr. I'm on both of those places as Andrew Isla.
And I'm on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, DeviantArt, Etsy, Society6. Just taking over the entire internet.
All over the place.
Yes. And you can find links to everywhere that I'm at by going to my personal website, jojoseems.com. JOJOSEAMES.
So that about wraps it up for this episode of Disney Dissected. We'll see you again in 2 weeks. And until then, keep on brilling. New podcast. It's about fish.